It's United States against Luster.
May it please the court, your honors. My name is Jack Crawford.
Crawford, your name will be called when we are ready.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge.
Mr. Crawford.
I apologize for being over anxious, your honor. My name is Jack Crawford, lawyer from Indianapolis, Indiana. I was appointed through the Criminal Justice Act to represent Mr. Luster at the trial of this matter and on appeal. Mr. Luster was indicted along with seven other co-defendants in the summer of 2004 and charged with conspiracy to distribute, to possess with intent to distribute, in excess of 5 kilograms of cocaine in violation of 21 United States Code, sections 841 and 846. He proceeded to trial by jury in the summer of 2005, the only defendant to proceed to trial. He was sentenced in November by the Honorable Sarah Evans Barker of the Southern District of Indiana in November of 2005 to a sentence of 200 months imprisonment. He appeals his conviction on three grounds, Your Honor: the sufficiency of the evidence, the alleged erroneous admission of prior uncharged misconduct, specifically the prior delivery of drugs from Mr. Prentice Davis to Mr. Luster some 3 years before the start of the conspiracy, and lastly, an enhancement of 2 levels for possession of a firearm. Your Honor, indeed, the government proved throughout the trial of these proceedings a large conspiracy emanating from the Keeping It Real Productions music studio in Indianapolis, Indiana, in the summer of 2003 and throughout the early months of 2004. It was not a minimal conspiracy. It involved the importation of some 560 kilograms of cocaine per year over the course of some 3 years, the cocaine coming from Chicago to Indianapolis. It is the contention of Defendant Luster.
I think it probably came from someplace other than Chicago. There's very little coca fields around Chicago.
The only connection, Judge, obviously, Judge, it indeed did come from some other place than Chicago, Illinois, but at least from the evidence produced, the only persons charged were Mr. Roger Rucker, who supplied the cocaine to Mr. Prentice Davis, who thereupon supplied it to his distributor, Mr. Jermaine Johnson, who was assisted by 2 other co-defendants, and they proceeded to distribute the cocaine in Indianapolis, Indiana. Your Honors, it's the contention of Appellant Luster that Mr. Luster was a small player in this very large conspiracy, and indeed was, in essence, only had a buyer-seller relationship with Mr. Johnson. And since Mr. Johnson did not testify in the case, the record is really bereft of any substantive evidence as to the true nature of the relationship between Jermaine Johnson and Dwayne Luster, other than during the month of February of 2004, Johnson distributed as on 8 or 9 occasions as much as anywhere from 2.5 or 2.25 ounces to 9 ounces of cocaine to Mr. Luster. But there's no evidence, Your Honors, as to the true nature of that relationship. And as this court found in United States versus Contreras, a 3-0 decision in 2001, in which Judge Rovner wrote the opinion vacating Mr. Contreras' conviction for conspiracy to distribute, possess with intention to distribute cocaine, Judge Rovner found in that case...
Counsel, the author of an opinion is not finding things. The court speaks as an institution. It makes no difference who wrote the opinion.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court found in that case that Mr. Contreras' relationship with his supplier, which involved 10 one-kilogram quantities of cocaine distributed from Mr. Contreras' supplier to Mr. Contreras over a period of 6 to 10 months, was not in and of itself enough to prove anything beyond a buyer-seller relationship. The court said that the evidence reveals nothing more about the circumstances and terms of Contreras' transactions with his supplier. There is no evidence, for example, that the supplier fronted the cocaine to Contreras. There's no evidence the supplier gave Contreras favorable prices on the cocaine on expectation of future purchases. And it goes on to set forth the various factors which distinguish a buyer-seller relationship from a conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute cocaine. And, Judge, Your Honors, I would contend that Mr. Luster's connection with Mr. Jermaine Johnson, Mr. Johnson was the supplier, Mr. Luster was the purchaser, was nothing more than that. And that's all the evidence revealed in these cases. There's no evidence from the record as to whether or not drugs were fronted from Jermaine Johnson to Mr. Luster.
I thought there was a seizure of some sort of a ledger that showed sales on credit.
Your Honor, that case or that ledger may have referred to amounts of money that Mr. Luster owed other persons. I'm not sure it showed that any evidence of any credit purchases. I don't believe that that ledger was indicative of a credit relationship between Mr. Luster and Mr. Johnson.
Owed without having credit.
I'm sorry,
amounts owed are amounts of credit.
Judge, I believe they showed the amounts that people owed him for his sales rather than what he owed other persons for fronted drugs. And there was no connection as to that document as to time, anything as to time. And I don't believe Mr. Johnson was on that document either. There were other persons on that document, which once again indicated that Mr. Luster had other persons bringing him cocaine. And the point being, Judge, that in order to establish the element of the conspiracy, there has to be some evidence that Mr. Johnson depended on Mr. Luster as a distributor or customer for him, that they had an interlocking, if you will, relationship and business dependence and mutual trust.
Weren't there all sorts of intercepted phone calls in which Mr. Luster is using the highly particularized lingo of this particular conspiracy, using the phrases T-shirt and tank top and whole outfit, etc., to refer to different quantities of cocaine?
Yes, Your Honor. There were about 30 phone calls in which Johnson and Luster are talking about T-shirts and tank tops, which are code words for certain amounts of drugs. But those words were tossed around loosely by all persons involved in the periphery of this drug operation.
But the evidence was that those words were particular to this conspiracy. Those aren't generalized street terms for particular quantities of cocaine, right?
Correct, Your Honor. In fact, a T-shirt indicated 4.5 ounces, and a tank top, because it didn't have the sleeves, was half of a T-shirt or 2.25 ounces.
Why isn't that enough to sustain the jury's verdict?
I don't think that is enough to make the inference that Mr. Luster was involved in an ongoing relationship, simply because he knew the right words to ask. Mr. Johnson may have said those words at some time. Mr. Luster said the right words, and he got his delivery of cocaine. But his relationship with Johnson is completely unexplained by the evidence in this case. Johnson had drugs to sell. Luster wanted to purchase those drugs, and he would do that. And Johnson would sometimes bring the drugs to Luster. But there's not, as this court has found on several times, the standard is there an adequate indicia of a concrete interlocking interest between the individuals in the buy-sell transactions? And I would submit, Your Honor, there is not.
Johnson is concerned, was he getting his stuff from Davis?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Was his source Davis?
Yes. Johnson received his cocaine from Prentice Davis, Justice.
And I know there's objection to the prior transaction or failed transaction or whatever you call it between Luster and Davis. It seems that sort of an inverse, instead of fronting it, Davis refused to sell to Luster because Luster didn't pay. Therefore, Johnson wants to take a risk, that's okay, but not him. Is that an implication that Luster was aware of the source and everybody's aware of who's good credit and bad credit, or no credit at all, as some say? It's knowledge of the conspiracy. I don't know. And then the benefit is that he found somebody in between that's willing to, I guess, take a risk on him when Davis wouldn't.
Judge Manning, I feel that's a possible inference. I don't feel it's a fair inference to jump from that to the fact that Luster knew about the entire chain of delivery in the conspiracy.
Well, he doesn't have to know about all of it. Just know that there's, I mean, you'd say the entire chain. You mean the original source or not the original?
From Chicago, from Mr. Rucker to Mr. Davis to Mr. Johnson to Mr. Luster. He did not have to know. The government only has to prove a conspiracy or agreement with one person. In fact, it could be an unnamed person. But I don't think the fact that he had this prior dealing with Davis and Davis cut him off, so to speak, would necessarily infer that Luster would know that Johnson had some association with Davis. There's nothing in the record to show that. Which brings me to my second point, Your Honors, which is the court's allowance of the prior dealing between Prentice Davis and Mr. Luster, in which the court ruled that evidence of a prior transaction occurring in the year 2000 should be admitted in evidence, and the defendant feels that that was in contravention of Rule 404B and not relevant. My time has expired, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Ridgway.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Cynthia Ridgway. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Indiana, and I represent the appellee. To first address what Mr. Crawford first addressed, the sufficiency of the evidence, when we look at a buyer-seller relationship or conspirators, we look basically at the nature of their relationship. What type of relationship did the two or more individuals share? And what this court has directed us to do is look at whether or not there is a shared stake between the individuals, whether or not there is mutual trust, and the standard whether or not there is a standardized way that the two or more individuals conduct their business. In the instant case, Your Honors, Mr. Luster and Mr. Johnson had a shared stake, and that is evidenced by some of the facts that came out in front of the trial, in front of the jury in this case. Mr. Johnson drove to Mr. Luster's house on numerous occasions to deliver the cocaine. It was after Mr. Johnson received a call from Mr. Davis that the cocaine was available that Mr. Johnson would then immediately and standardized call Mr. Luster to let him know that the cocaine was available. He would then, Mr. Johnson, sometimes deliver personally the cocaine to Mr. Luster, and on several occasions would actually drive Mr. Luster to his then further customers. The mutual trust and shared stake is also evidenced by the fact that on one occasion, when Mr. Luster knew that Mr. Johnson was en route to his residence, Mr. Luster called Mr. Johnson to tell him not to come to the residence. They had a shared stake at making sure that the two of them continued successful on this conspiracy to possess with the intent to distribute. And in that shared stake, Mr. Luster wanted to warn Mr. Johnson that there were unannounced or uninvited guests that had come to his residence and did not want Mr. Johnson to be in danger of his identity being revealed, so he called to warn Mr. Johnson. On February 8th, there were three telephone calls that were recorded pursuant to our authority with the district court. And those three calls are key to evidence the standardized transaction between Mr. Johnson and Mr. Luster. You will hear that we heard in the record that Mr. Johnson received a phone call from Mr. Davis that, in fact, the cocaine was available. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Johnson then called Mr. Luster and said it was time for the transaction. This wasn't a buyer-seller relationship where Mr. Luster was calling his distributor or his source to say, hey, do you have any cocaine? This was Mr. Johnson saying, hey, it's available because I just got a call from my source, Mr. Davis. Shortly after Mr. Johnson called Mr. Luster returned the call and said, yes, in fact, I would like to order, and then ordered a quantity of cocaine, and as the court has referenced, in fact, used the specific code language to this particular conspiracy. In addition, just with regard to the buyer-seller or the sufficiency of the evidence, this court also instructed the jury on the fact that buyer-seller arrangements or relationships is not sufficient. With regard to the 404B that Mr. Crawford alluded to, Your Honors, there's plenty of evidence, plenty of reasons to support the district court's finding in this case of the applicability of Federal Rule of Evidence 404B and the admission of that 2000 fronting of the drugs between Mr. Davis and Mr. Luster in this case. Not only is intent to distribute in this drug conspiracy an issue, but the court also knows that knowledge of actually possessing narcotics is an issue and absence of mistake. There are three separate reasons, separate and apart from propensity to commit a crime, that are relevant in this case. When you look through whether or not the act was similar or close enough in time, you see that it occurred within 3 years, and this court on several occasions has found even a 9-year span to be sufficient, similar enough, and close enough in time. With regard to the, unless the court has further questions with regard to the 404B evidence, I'll just talk briefly about the enhancement, the 2D1.1B1 enhancement for the reasonable foreseeability of the firearm. And as the court knows, what the district court found was that beyond by a preponderance of the evidence, it was reasonably foreseeable for Mr. Lester to know that his co-conspirators possessed firearms. When you look at reasonable foreseeability, you look at the person and their circumstances. And here, Your Honors, Mr. Lester, at the time of the conspiracy, was subject to his third conviction for possession of a firearm himself. So the possession of a firearm was not in and of itself unreasonable for him to believe a person might do, and certainly here, Mr. Lester did that illegally. You also look to the fact that Mr. Lester had been at the Prentice Davis music studio before and that he was a close companion of Mr. Johnson. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. Otherwise, I would respectfully ask that the court affirm the district court's decisions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. And Mr. Crawford, we thank you for your willingness to accept the appointment, and the assistance you've been both to your client and the court.
Thank you.